Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
But you don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swampfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
It's not going to be easy picking out the most dramatic moment from what was an eventful weekend in the Premier League. But as you're putting me on the spot, Second Captain's podcast listeners, I think I'll have to go for Granit Xhaka's reaction to getting substituted for Arsenal against Crystal Palace yesterday. Welcome to the Bank Holiday Football Podcast. Owen Ken here. Hi, Ken.
I can't believe you went for Xhaka. Wow.
It was dramatic. The decision to take him off was greeted with cheers from many of the home supporters, prompting Xhaka, Arsenal captain, to wave his arms up and down in the come on, let's be Avenue gesture. That got the fans even more riled up. The reaction intensified, to which Xhaka cupped his ears, shouting various curses at the crowd before eventually whipping the jersey off. And oh my God, is he about to fling the jersey into the crowd or throw it on the ground and stamp it into the Emirates turf? This will be the greatest exit interview a footballer has ever done. Well, no, he stopped short of that. He thought better of it, if that thought even popped into his head. Still, though, this was an intense viewing experience.
Some Arsenal fans actually cheering as they take off their captain, Granit Xhaka, who looks rather unimpressed by being hauled off at this stage. He's going to be replaced by Bukayo Saka, who started the last four Premier League games. And Xhaka's reaction there, not good. Not good at all, as he's virtually jeered off by his own fans. The shirt comes off, and Xhaka is away down the tunnel, booed by the Arsenal fans.
That's how they called it on DAZN. Ken, what do you make of all that?
Well, I felt really sorry for Xhaka.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's just such a strange thing to see that. I mean, it's not strange, actually, at Arsenal. We've seen him before.
Emmanuel Eboué?
Eboué. Remember Eboué? But, you know, it's not really... I mean, it's Eboué was the most similar to that I've seen from Arsenal, where the stadium turns on a player who's being substituted. On that occasion, Eboué himself had come on as a sub and played so badly that he was subbed off, and the whole place went mad. And I think Abue's reaction was a bit different. He kind of crumbled a bit more than Xhaka. I mean, Xhaka was crumbling in his
own
way.
In a different way, in a more aggressive
way.
Manner, yeah.
But, like, well, you know, where do you see that kind of thing? You know, I mean, it just struck me. Like, I mean, the Abue thing is 11 years ago. And since then, you know, the climate we live in is a little bit different, I think, in terms of, like, the supposed duty of empathy that people have for others going through very difficult situations, especially like a mass public shaming like this. You know, it's literally like a whole stadium turning on one guy and abusing this guy.
Well, that still happens a lot, but maybe it happens more online now. We just don't see it in person as much anymore.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's when was the last time you saw a stadium like attacking
one of
this
their
is the
players.
Captain of the team as well. This yeah, is the captain. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously, at Arsenal, there's been like, you know, Wenger was attracting this type of reaction from a lot of the fans. But it was always more complex with Wenger because everybody kind of loved him as well. Mm. You know, it was a, even the people who really hated him felt really guilty about that because they also loved him. You know, it was very complex.
Yeah, it was Arsene, please just put yourself and us out of this misery we're all in. Please.
Yeah, it's just, but in this case, he has no friends. Emery has no friends. It's more vicious. But like, I felt sorry for Xhaka because, how would anyone? What he did was the wrong. Emery said repeatedly he was wrong. He was wrong.
Ian Wright said he should apologize to the supporters.
Well, I'm sure he feels like he shouldn't. Why should he apologize? Why shouldn't they apologize? Aren't they supposed to be supporters? What a joke that is.
Isn't he supposed to be a professional footballer? And one of your professional duties is not to actually lash out at your own fans, even if they are giving.
Does it say that in the contract? I mean, it says that in Neymar's contract. It specifies a bonus. It specifies a bonus for not doing that, but
I think it's an understood part of being a footballer that this shit happens sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, you hear people say, oh, he's not a captain. Why is he a captain? And whether he should be the captain, I don't think he should, because I feel as though he shouldn't really be in the team. I don't see the place for him in the team. And he keeps getting substituted, which is not good for if you're the captain. It's like, why is it always you that we're taking off? And it's not good. But you know, he is, and he was voted by his teammates, I guess. I mean, Emery is the player, is the person who should be making the decision, I think.
Good evening.
Did you see his post-match interview?
I didn't see the good evening part. I saw him on Match of the Day.
Unai, what did you make of VAR today?
Strange decision. Good evening.
He nearly forgot.
He momentarily forgot himself. But then he remembered to go back to his...
It might start getting later and later. Just as he gets more rattled, he'll be midway through the interview and then just, good evening.
Never at any cost abandon your stiff robotic formality when talking about even the craziest of games. You'd have to have sympathy for Xhaka. I mean, people are like, oh, this guy's not a captain. Why is he the captain? He's the captain of every team he's ever played for. He's the captain of Borussia Mönchengladbach. He's the captain of Switzerland. And he's now the captain of Arsenal. Now, it may seem difficult to understand for anybody who doesn't share a dressing room with Xhaka. I think part of being a captain is that you should be one of the best players in the team because you're supposed to be playing all the time and it's awkward if you don't deserve to, you know. But he clearly does. I mean, did you see Torreira's reaction?
Yeah, he was very upset.
Torreira was like crying. Mm. Oh, I can't believe what's happening here. And Bellerin was coming around was sort of comforting Torreira on the sideline. And I see Bellerin has tweeted some supportive stuff about Xhaka or we are all humans. We all have emotions. Sometimes it's not easy dealing with them. It's time to lift each other up, not to push each other away. We only win when we are together. Come on, you Gunners. That's Bayreen's message. But like, I don't know, to go through something like that.
Yeah, on a personal level, I can see why you would feel sympathy for him.
He's a highly emotional guy. You know, you can tell that from all the red cards. Hmm. You know, he's a player who loses the head a lot. And he lost the head when, you know, he was being cheered. I mean, I've seen it happen to Kevin Kilbane, for instance. Mm. Kevin Kilbane in an Ireland game was subbed off in the crowd. Yeah, you know that, like, oh, at last. Yeah, that cheer.
It's horrible. It's horrible. But I imagine Kevin Kilbane didn't start flipping the bird or whatever it might
stripping
be.
Stripping the shirt off. Yeah. You know, telling everyone to fuck off. He did not do that.
No.
He trotted off, head down. He took his beating from the crowd like a man. Now, I don't know. Do we think... It's appropriate. I mean, it's kind of weird. It's like the sympathy should be with Xhaka here, right? But all I hear is people saying, oh, Xhaka should apologize for being abused by everybody. He should apologize. It's like, well, should he? Like, you shouldn't really act like that. But then again, this is the way football is. It's like, if you don't get attacked by your own fans, then don't play really badly. And certainly when they abuse you when you're coming off, don't in any way respond to the abuse by allowing your own emotions to show, because then the abuse will come back on you a thousandfold. That's the message.
And the abuse, I should say, is only going to get worse if instance of this, you know, if Arsenal fans take the hump with this. So Xhaka is going to need some coping mechanisms, some little tricks of the mind that could distract him from the abuse raining down from the stands. You know, this kind of thing.
A stadium, when you're on the pitch, is just full of signs and you can see words. And I would number them. So this is 5 and that's 7. So if you interchange 7 and 5, this still spells Harry Lads, right?
Right.
Now, this sounds absurd, and we really should move past this quickly.
But if you swap 4 and 6, it would say Hell Wads.
Right, well...
This is the kind of stuff you were doing.
Yeah, I would just occupy my mind with mundane little spelling games or just bullshit, because if I'm doing that, I can't hear what they're saying.
Granite Xhaka, we have Richie's number. If you want some more of those. I still don't fully understand what he was doing. I think I do. I think I'm on top of what Richie was doing there. We've got the Report on Sport coming right up. And then we're going to have a couple of visitors to studio, Ken. Billy and Jez, otherwise known as the F2, who are in town to promote their new book.
F2 Freestylers now.
F2 Ultimate Footballer is the new book. So give us a lowdown on these fellas.
Oh, come on, Owen. You have YouTube on your phone, did you?
I'm a 39-year-old...
Jesus.
Human being, Ken. I think I might be slightly over the target market, age-wise.
Well, you're not interested in skills? You don't care about football skills?
I'm not going to get any better at this age.
Well, certainly not football. with that kind of attitude.
Yeah, you know, I'm playing once every couple of weeks, max.
Yeah.
I don't know. All the YouTube videos in the world mightn't help me.
You're a bit of a Granite Xhaka, actually.
Granite Xhaka?
Yeah, you've got a bit of his attitude.
Wow.
Similar.
I'm just a bit of a moan bag sometimes. But listen, this isn't about me. It's about the F2.
Well, look, they do. I mean, everybody, apart from you, Owen, knows who these people are. Well, if you know...
I know where they are now because we're interviewing them today.
They're very, very big YouTubers, essentially. Mm. Although they kind of have a business empire now. They have like a full-on, clothing range, talent agency. I think this is their fifth book.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Like they're pumping out a lot of commercial material.
If I was 10 years of age, this is probably how I'd be learning football. Even more so than, well, maybe as an accompaniment to watching Messi and Ronaldo and whoever.
Absolutely. You're
watching these guys on YouTube.
Yes. So, you know, they'll go and do videos with like players at training grounds. I mean, I've seen a few other things with different, like the sort of top players, and they concentrate on different skills and kind of measure themselves against the players and set up little competitions and, you know, yeah. Like they do very popular YouTube videos. So, Owen,
I'm ready to learn, Ken.
Yes.
Ready to learn today. This is your Bank Holiday podcast. If you're listening as a World Service member, we're going to bring you the Rugby Show tomorrow to reflect on Eddie Jones's finest hour. Was it his finest or one of his many fine hours at World Cups? That's going to be on the World Service tomorrow. Today, it's all about the football. Let's report on said football, please, Ken.
Just before we get on to that, maybe I was mistaken in what I was saying about the rugby on Friday.
What were you saying on Friday?
Well, making an argument that, in fact, skills were key component in rugby.
You don't believe they are?
Maybe it's actually just about...
being coached by Eddie Jones.
Well, that always helps. But ultimately, about pushing your opponent out of the way. Could we just push them out of the way?
Are you mostly talking about New Zealand, about South Africa, Wales? Which was a match devoid of skill, largely.
I didn't see any of the England-New Zealand match.
Oh, no, England were amazing.
Yeah.
So like they were pushing New Zealand, as you say, out of the way, Ken, but they were also running around them, chipping over them, just generally dominating them for most of the match. South Africa-Wales, a little less of that, a little more, we'll push hard, you push hard, we push hard, you push hard, and then we win by 3 points.
Yeah, it wasn't... the last kind of 20 minutes of it was quite good. So that was a try, Wales scored a try.
It was gripping in its own... Dour way. I think it's fine, though. I think it's good to have two semi-finals that are completely different to each other. Not everyone is going to play the same way, so that's all right. There's room for the South African Wales of this world. I mean, I think we would have taken a heroic defeat like Wales had to sign off on Joe Schmidt's reign as Wales signed off on Warren Gatland's, put it that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, the rugby tomorrow.
Okay. So let's start with that Arsenal game, because that was, in its own way, the big attraction of the weekend. I mean... So Arsenal, obviously, the Emirates has tasted blood and is thirsty for more, you know? And there was this kind of uneasy honeymoon period for Unai Emery where people were like sort of waiting to be impressed. And now that's over and nobody's impressed and everybody's angry and things are going bad at a fearsome rate. And actually, the drama for this game the Crystal Palace game started before the game, when Unai Emery did his press conference and revealed, somewhat surprisingly, that Mesut Ozil's exclusion from the team is not simply his decision, but has in fact been a collective decision taken by the entire Arsenal hierarchy.
Right.
Here we have one agreed strategy as a club and as a team, because the most important thing is the club, the team, and finding a performance. Previously, we were all speaking between us to take that decision. I know all the supporters want to know something, but now is not the moment. Now, when he says, I know all the supporters want to know something, what they want to know is, why are you leaving Mesut Ozil out of the team? And it's a situation that's become aggravated by the struggles of the team, particularly the fact that there doesn't really seem to be any big link up here in this team. Like, it's like we were talking the other day after the Sheffield United Arsenal game, the formation resembling like a thought bubble, like where it begins with Guendouzi in midfield and then just sort of goes upfield towards this general area where everybody else is standing. And it's like, what's going on? This doesn't look like a sophisticated system, like a way of breaking down an opposing defense. This is just like giving the ball to Guendouzi and hoping he can pick someone out in space, but he can't because like everybody's just standing there up front.
Speaking of the rugby, good hit by Guendouzi late on to stop.
That was unbelievable.
But how
is that not a red card?
I don't know.
Like that should have been a red card. Like I like Guendouzi. I think he's a good player. But that was taking the piss. You cannot do that. Like number one, it could have been a red card because there's no way they're catching Zaha. Yeah. He's actually through, even though he's 70 yards away from goal. He's through on goal.
Yeah.
So it should have been like a professional foul. It should have been counted as like if I can differentiate between a professional foul, like a straight red card, and a tactical foul, like a yellow card foul that you commit in midfield because a guy's got away from you. Like the kind Fernandinho got sent off for, incredibly, in the Man City game. Fernandinho is it like Jack Pidbrun says, this is like seeing John Gotti go to prison at last. This is, you know, for him to actually be punished. Mm. He actually only ends up missing a League Cup game. So it was a good time to do it. But the point about Guendouzi is, if you're beaten so badly that you can't even trip the guy who's getting away from you in the standard manner, and you have to resort to actually taking him out with a tackle, which I think would have even been a foul in rugby because he didn't wrap around.
Yeah. Possibly even high.
Then that's a red card. That should be a red card. It's like, you can't do that.
It looked violent enough to be a red card, even taking aside the professional foul aspect to it, but
he could maybe argue, you could maybe say in his defense, maybe this was actually a safer way for Zaha of bundling him to the ground than maybe hacking wildly at him as he went past, which maybe you could have injured him worse. But I just think you can't, like, we all know what you're doing there, but that should be a red card. But look, it wasn't like this was the biggest issue of the day for...
I just thought it was amusing. Well,
it was hilarious. It was hilarious, but like at the same time, it's kind of like, I don't... What's the referee doing here? That's a red. But look...
So what was the key? What's your key takeaway then from what Arsenal were up to?
Well, first of all, that Ozil thing really surprised me that Emery came out and said that, because he's dragging everyone else into it. These are the people, by the way, who have to support him, whose consent, we're not talking about all the people at the Emirates who are howling for his blood, right? I mean, we know what they think. What's important for him is what do the other people who are running the club think, and he's now dragged them out with him to sort of answer for this Ozil situation. Now, the fact that this may be true, I mean, we only have his word for it, but the fact that this may be true is kind of irrelevant to the question of whether Emery is wise to behave in this way, because I think typically sort of directors at football clubs don't really like to have to be accountable in this way, like Emery was inviting them to be alongside him. The manager's there to do that. He's there to explain. He's the public face. He's there to explain what's going on. And if he suddenly starts saying, well, actually, we've all decided this, it undermines Emery in one sense, because it's like, oh, hang on, this isn't even your decision. You know what I mean? We kind of thought it was your decision, but now you're saying maybe it's not even your decision. Maybe you're just doing what you're told. You know, there's that. Then there's the issue of, okay, now everyone else is going to get also sharing in the blame for this.
Yeah, like I said, a big part of the job of management is to be the face of it, for better or worse. And there's a lot of better as well, by the way. If it goes really well, everyone thinks nobody really cares about what's going on behind the scenes. But if there's decisions like this, you're also the one who has to try to explain it away without dragging everyone else in.
Yeah, and then there's a question of, well, I just hope that the account that he gave in public was accurate and doesn't, that there aren't people, you know, on the board sort of scratching their heads and saying, hang on a second, I don't remember this meeting going exactly like that. I mean, there was that piece recently, was it Simon Hughes?
Brendan Rodgers?
Yeah.
Or was it Tony Evans?
Maybe it's Tony Evans.
I know the one. I know
in the Independent.
Yeah.
Where he had spoken about how Rodgers kind of lost the faith of some of the people over in New England, sort of the FSG people who were owning or kind of running the club, his bosses essentially, by coming out and saying things in public which they didn't think he should have been saying, or
they just didn't think were accurate either. Yeah.
Misrepresenting the situation. I want to tear him a new asshole. One of them was quoted as saying, so hopefully there aren't anyone on the board wanting to tear Marie Newhouse, because there's no shortage of people who want to do that at the moment. As for the last thing that he says about Ozil is, I know all the supporters want to know something, but now is not the moment. Now, the Arsenal fans were singing for Ozil yesterday, especially as in the last terminal phase of the disaster. The Ozil song was ringing out because it's kind of a rallying point for all of the anti-Emery feeling. Like, Ozil is the opposite of Emery. He's the guy who's been exiled. He's kind of been the victim of this misrule. But the thing is, Ozil, it's obvious why he's not playing. It's obvious to me. I mean, is it obvious to you?
No, it's not obvious that a player of that talent can't get into a team or even on a bench to unlock something in the last 20 minutes.
Well, he doesn't do anything. Like, he's,
how many assists
he's had it.
Has he not got some crazy amount of assists, you know, in the time that he's been in English football? He's right up near the top.
Look, he has, but like, if we look at him, okay, what's his stats over the last few seasons? 2014-15, 4 goals, 5 assists. This is league only, right? Mm. 2015-16, 6 goals, 19 assists. 19. Now, that's a good number.
That's a great number.
I mean, was that a record? It was certainly close to one for the Premier League. Arsenal, 2016-17, 8 goals, 9 assists. Then the next season, 4 goals, 8 assists. Then last season, okay, his numbers of games are dropping as well. 24 games, 5 goals, 2 assists. Mm. Now, that's, you know, 5 goals, 2 assists for like the supposed assist maestro. That's, you know, we're not talking about big numbers there. This season, he's only played 73 minutes and hasn't managed to, you know. But if you look at, say, for instance, his key passes, you know, this is like chance creation per 90. This isn't just assists. So in his good season, 2015-16, that's 4.29 per game. Last season, it's 2.31. So he's like half the player he was. Mm. He's not. Like, he's had it. Like, it's over. And they're trying to get rid of him because they made a bad decision to pay him too much money. So they're trying effectively to isolate him and force him out. Now, the risk for them is that he just sits there going, well, you know, I know how you feel about me, but I'm quite happy with the contract you've given me, and I'm fully entitled to serve it out, and does a kind of a Winston Bogart on it. You know what I mean? Winston Bogart is still the kind of outstanding example, even though there's other players who've done this since then. He was kind of the first to just sit there on massive, massive money.
But didn't he used to get a helicopter to and from training sometimes? I'll pop in, show my face.
No, that was Michael Owen.
Oh, was it? I thought he helicoptered back to somewhere else.
I think he lived in the Netherlands for quite a long
time.
Okay.
You
know, or he was obviously from there, and he kind of based himself
here and there.
There.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, Ozil could do that. So, I mean, Arsenal trying to force him out, and this might not work. In the meantime, he's still there, and he's become this rallying point against Emery. So this massive problem for him, undermining him. Whether he'd actually make any difference, I don't know. But you do have to also look at Arsenal's team and notice that this exile of Ozil couldn't have happened at a worse time, really. Because if you look at them last season, you would have thought their four main attacking midfield players are Ozil, Henrik Mkhitaryan, Aaron Ramsey.
Don't look around at Killian like that. We're leaving all that in.
Oh my God.
Adam.
I was just like, hang on. Alan, that doesn't sound right.
He's only gone. Ramsey. It's only gone a season. Playing for Juventus, of course.
Playing for Juventus. Who did I say? And Iwobi.
Yeah.
Now, what about these players?
Andrew Iwobi, yeah.
Right. Iwobi is now Iwobi of Everton. A toffee man. Mkhitaryan is at Roma. Ramsey, as he mentioned, is Juventus. And Ozil is in the stands. So, hang on a second. Well, who's the, where is this supposed to be coming from? Now, what they have now instead is they've signed Pepe. Pepe was their big signing. Pepe's a good player, but he's a player of a particular type. He is a winger who wants to cut inside from the right side. That's, he's a goal scoring winger who starts right and moves in. Okay, like, this is nothing against him. I think he's a useful player in the right type of team. For instance, you know, he plays, it's comparable, I suppose, to Salah at Liverpool, that type of position, this type of role. But Salah's playing in a system where there's room for exactly that player. He's playing, yesterday it was Lacazette, Aubameyang and him up front. So you've got Lacazette and Aubameyang, who again are very good players. Aubameyang, brilliant. Like one of the best centre forwards in the world and has been scoring for Arsenal at a phenomenal rate. But in order to get both of them in the team, how do you do it? The solution yesterday was Aubameyang left, Lacazette in the middle, Pepe right. But what you've got is Aubameyang wants to be in the middle and it's kind of not really that much use out wide. Lacazette is sort of the same. He also wants to be in the box and Pepe wants to go in there. So you've got this kind of confused and constricted three players who are kind of getting in each other's way, really. They're not complementing each other. They're kind of obstructing each other. And then behind them, you've got this midfield, which again doesn't work. I think there's a similar problem with Guendouzi and Xhaka. So this is another reason why I feel a bit sorry for Xhaka. There's no room for him in the team because Guendouzi is doing the job that he would be doing in the team. Xhaka is a midfielder who's like a playmaking midfielder. He's like, his strengths are, I can pass the ball well, I can see the pitch, I can switch the play. Okay, Guendouzi does all that, except he's better than you at lots of other things as well. So it's like, they don't complement each other, and Guendouzi's more dominant. Xhaka ends up standing there and kind of passing the ball to Guendouzi, or watching Guendouzi do all this stuff, and consequently being useless. It's like, what's he even doing? This is the weird thing about it. It's like, for a player who was not really very, very involved in the game, how did he attract so much venom? Because Ian Wright, I think, showed a couple of clips of him hiding from the ball, you know what I mean, or kind of walking around in such a way as to make it, no one's going to pass me the ball here.
I wasn't sure about that package. I don't know, maybe they're just looking for a couple of the clips they showed. I thought, a little harsh. Yeah. You know, he was in position, and in some cases the player in possession of the ball didn't even turn around to look at where he was. They were receiving the ball and they were already ready to play it back the direction that it came from. So yeah, one or two of them, fine. He didn't look like he was, so just, I just think sometimes I understand the point that Ian Wright is making. There's just one that stands out that essentially I thought was a little bit much. But
well, the thing is,
it's the least of what Xhaka has been receiving over the last couple of days.
Hiding from the ball is something the crowd usually doesn't even notice.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's a crowd isn't going to notice that because the crowd is usually following the ball, and the player who's hiding from it is nowhere near it. Or you know, it's just
a nice safe 20-25 yards away.
Yeah, or just a little bit too close to the potential interceptors. To you know, no one's going to pass me the ball if I stand just over here. I mean, I seem to be making myself available. You know, this is a point he was making. But like, it doesn't work. Like Aubameyang was barely involved. He didn't touch the ball in the box, I don't think. He definitely didn't get the ball in the box. He had two shots from outside. I was looking at his outside the box. I don't think he ever scored in the league from outside the box for Borussia Dortmund. But he's got four for Arsenal so far, which tells you that he's shooting more from bad positions than he ever did when he was at Dortmund. Maybe Arsenal don't have the same rules as Dortmund do. Dortmund are like, don't shoot from out here. Just wait till you're in the middle in front of the goal. That's the best place. Get in there and then shoot. Whereas with Arsenal, it's kind of like, well, son, you know, you're the footballer. Go out there and show me what you can do. And so he scored some long-range goals, but like, it's kind of a waste for him to be shooting from there. Yeah. So you got all of these sort of problems, all these issues, players that don't kind of complement each other, or a manager who's failed to find a way to build some kind of a system where they can. And I should mention David Luiz. He did score a goal, but he also gave one away. So
par. He's hit par.
I thought his defending on the equalizing goal was not good. However,
the celebration was great, though. Very, very manly.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of chest beating, David Luiz, machismo.
It was good stuff. But like, you know what could he do? Like, I mean, Arsenal fans are like, oh, well, what about Torreira? But Torreira, like, Torreira seems like he should complement Guendouzi a bit more, because if Guendouzi is the playmaker midfielder, Torreira will be the running, tackling, ball-winning midfielder. But Emery has said, no, I think I see him playing further forward, which bemuses everybody, because he's shown zero creative or attacking skills, really. I mean, he scored that overhead goal last season. But generally, he's, you know, it's a bit like Chelsea fans complaining about Kante being played out of position, but talking about him, a player who's nowhere near as good as Kante. You know what I mean? But some of the same issues. What Emery's really saying is, I don't trust this guy in front of my defense. He's kind of a disaster. Like, he runs around kicking people and fouling and getting cards. It's like,
yeah,
you know, that's why Emery's saying, no, I if he's in the team, I see him a little further forward. Not like, so they don't really have a system. You've got all these players who are becoming victims of it. Everyone's looking at Pepe going, what's this guy? Why do we spend so much money on this guy? You know, Aubameyang is like, oh, he's not even involved. Aubameyang's the best player in your team, by the way. You know, Xhaka, what's he even doing there? It's like, well, what is he supposed to do? You know, it's, so they're being made to look bad. The crowd's turning on them. Crowd's turning on the manager. They're turning on the crowd. It's really...
Yeah, it's a lot of problems.
It's a lot of problems. So it's not good. Not good. So that's it. What more can we say?
I mean, no, there's plenty about Arsenal. Yeah, I was just wondering if you want to talk about anyone else.
They were all complaining about the VAR as well, but honestly, I couldn't really. Although VAR seemed to sort of assert itself more this weekend, right? Like, yeah, giving penalties and stuff.
Yeah, well, it was more positive in the sense of giving chances.
Hey, don't forget us. Yeah. We're over here as well. We can stick our oar in. And they did, and overruled the referee in the Arsenal game because he'd originally booked Zaha for diving for the penalty.
Well, that was a great one. Mm. That was a great. If they got that overrule correct, as was said after the game, I can't remember by who. It was Roy Hodgson. Roy Hodgson saying, well, look, the ref should be thanking VAR there, because that gets him out of a hole. You know, he would have ended up booking my player for diving, which he didn't do. Mm. Which Zaha hadn't done. So that got overruled. But the more controversial one was the Socrates disallowed goal.
Oh, yeah,
that,
yeah.
Chambers, you know, Chambers was a judge to have failed in the build-up to.
Yeah.
Pretty marginal.
It was a bit. Yeah, you didn't. No one. It was one of those. No one had noticed it at the time.
Yeah.
Bit like Aaron Connolly's one.
Mm-hmm.
You thought. What did you think of Aaron Connolly's penalty? Clear penalty, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's got to be. Everything Aaron Connolly touches turns to a
penalty. Yeah. Two assists for Aaron Connolly, both by getting fouled and winning a free kick and the penalty.
Well, that's not a bad quality to have.
It's pretty good. What else? Oh, in the other Irish news, you were doing Sheffield United game, weren't you?
On Premier Sports, yeah. West Ham, Sheffield United.
Sheffield United could not be beaten by West Ham. The Blades and the Irons. David McGoldrick, I noticed, has missed more big chances than anyone else in the league, apart from Tammy Abraham.
Oh, really?
Tammy Abraham and David McGoldrick both have missed 7 big chances, which is quite a lot in 10 matches. I'm like, Dave, you got to stick one of these in at some point. Look, the other players in the top 5 missed chances are Abraham, McGoldrick, Firmino, Mane, and Sterling. So it's good company.
Yeah, it shows they're all getting into positions, yes, which is important. That's, and McGoldrick was, I think Kenny Cunningham did a halftime package on how McGoldrick started really badly. The whole Sheffield United team started terribly. You know, sometimes after a big win, it's like you can say everything you want, but the next game you do kind of take your eye off the ball a little bit. That happened to them, that happened to him, he was terrible. But when David McGoldrick is bad, he looks really bad, if you take my point.
Mm.
He can sometimes look a little bit like, if the touch is off a little bit, it's like, what is this guy? But then he picked it up. Actually, I thought he was quite good for most of the rest of the game from about the half hour mark on.
Did he?
But now you've just brought me back down to earth saying,
well, look,
give me those stats.
Again, we're talking about the elite strikers in the Premier League are in the top 5. Mm-hmm. Abraham, the top scorer, Firmino, Mane, Sterling. I mean, these are the best players in the league. They're all among them, and McGoldrick's in there as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll sit back and wait for those goals to start flowing pretty soon.
Impressed by Liverpool?
Yeah. I mean, this was a So this was kind of the biggest game you would have thought before the weekend, before this explosion at Arsenal of drama. But it was a huge game for both Liverpool and Tottenham. With Liverpool, it was, can they win? Can they keep this? Because a draw, you know, a draw is letting City back in. Even though this is a game that City themselves did not win, the home game against Tottenham. They drew this, if you remember, it was 2-2.
This is quite a similar game, I thought, in that City were so dominant that day and yet dropped points. And I thought the same was going to happen to Liverpool.
Yeah, especially, I mean, they conceded a goal in the first minute. And, you know, again, this was like, with Tottenham, it was like having had that big win against Red Star where suddenly things seemed to be flowing again for them. Could they keep that up? But then Pochettino made a few changes. One of them being enforced. Lamela was injured. Lamela had had a good game in midweek. He was actually injured. That was a problem. Eriksen was back in the team. Ndombele was left out. That was kind of a bit of a controversy. It's like, well,
what you sign him for?
What? Yeah, you know, it is. It's quite frustrating when you get like a big signing who seems to be going well, and then suddenly a big game, and no, you're back out of the team. In the event, actually, Sissoko. I mean, it was Winks and Sissoko in midfield. Sissoko helped to make the Tottenham goal. Henderson gave the ball away. Henderson dawdling on the ball. And then obviously, I mean, it's just such a classic Henderson narrative. You know what I mean? His part in that goal was interesting. He gave the ball away. He was under no pressure. Then he dawdled on the ball and took a couple of kind of clumsy touches. And now he is under pressure and then he loses it. And his two partners in midfield have not taken into account the likelihood he's going to lose this ball, because it just doesn't look like he can lose it at the beginning. And they're kind of a little bit caught by the sudden Tottenham winning the ball. Sissoko then comes running through a pretty poor attempt at a tackle by Wijnaldum. Sissoko powers through the entire midfield and Henderson runs back. Sissoko gets away from him again and gives it to Son. Then Henderson runs back again and Son is facing up to Alexander-Arnold. But Henderson is sent the same way as Arnold. Arnold kind of goes, okay, we're both here now. I'll make sure he doesn't cut left. And, oh, you were meant to make sure he didn't cut right, but you did the same as me. And now he's on the right. And he hits the shot off the head of Lovren, off the post, and then drops to Harry Kane, who scores. So then it's like, okay. Well, then Henderson, you know, again, just, you're like, how is he still playing for this team? And then, of course, well, that's why.
I think he's got a lot of mental strength, Ken, Jordan Henderson.
A lot of mental strength. He finished the game with 65% pass completion, which was the lowest by a long way in the Liverpool team. The next lowest was Firmino at 79%, but he's kind of playing at the very top of the team, so
risky passes and so on.
You'd expect Henderson to be more than, but look,
great finish though.
He kept plugging away. Well, it was, wasn't it? It was a good finish.
I thought it was sliced when it first went in. I thought that was a weird looking finish, but then you look at it again. No, he just caught it, hit it downwards.
Well, not an easy one to strike. He's basically okay. I'll keep it low and try and get it on target, and did that, and it was goal. I mean, the Spurs. I thought what happened after the goal was, then obviously when you get a goal like Tottenham did, you're like, oh, now we've got something to lose. You know, it changes the mindset a little bit. And Spurs then sat off, but they sat off too much. And then before long, they were being absolutely hammered. You know, and the goalkeeper was unbelievable. Yeah. Gazzaniga had just save after save. But it was really, you're like, oh, this, it's kind of sad what's happened to Tottenham now. You know, I was writing about it for the Irish Times. I was like, look, thinking back to the game they played 18 months ago, February last year, this was the game that finished 2-2. Salah scored two goals and Kane and Wanyama.
2018, we're talking.
Yeah. Kane scored a penalty. Wanyama scored a great goal. But it was like Tottenham completely dominated that game. You know, it's almost hard to think about this when Kane missed the penalty in the same game, so they probably should have won it, and they dominated. Like they had more shots, they had 2/3 of the possession. They were the team that was in charge.
2/3 of possession is incredible.
Yeah,
because even Spurs at their best, you didn't necessarily think, oh, this is a team that will be dominating the ball.
Yeah, well, again
in a match of that stature.
So you do have to factor in the order of the goals. In that game, Salah had scored the first goal, so there's a certain element of Tottenham now will have the ball. But, you know, still, they were able to dominate. It was like Liverpool were the ones that were hanging on. And it looked as though, if you remember, Salah scored like an amazing goal at the very end where he kind of beat a couple of players and scored. And it looked like they'd kind of snatched this, like, almost against the odds type of victory. And then Kane scored a penalty, actually, in the 95th minute. But the point about it is that Tottenham were the team that were in charge. And now Tottenham are just hanging on like a small team. You know what I mean? Like unable to compete, just hoping that they can cling on to this lead. And it's grim for, you know, if you're a Tottenham player to sort of still be part of this. So the question, I think, you do also have to say that there was a lot of good performances from Liverpool players, particularly Trent Alexander-Arnold, who had 20 crosses in the game. And some of the passes that he was playing were unbelievable.
It's insane.
And I was kind of wondering, will he be happy to stay at right back for very long?
Why wouldn't he be? He's playing great stuff.
He's playing great stuff, and he's in a team where he does have the sort of opportunity to show his talents, or at least show a lot of what's good about his game, you know, in the sense that it's kind of built around him in a way. You know, it's like to get him into good positions he can show his range of passing and so on and so forth. And obviously he assists lots of goals and is part of a team that wins all the time. So really, you think, couldn't be happier. At the same time though, did you notice the way later in the game it was like, oh, he's a bit ragged on the defensive side. Oh, you know, this is bad by Arnold. He stepped in field here. He's lucky that they haven't been able to pick out Son, you know. And I do wonder what happens when a couple of games happen when he gives a goal away with a move like that, you know, where it's like, oh, Trent, he just wants to attack. You know, he's forgot about Dre defensively, you know what I mean? And whether he'll then start to think, do I need this?
I don't see it that regularly, though, because this was the argument when he was dropped, remember, for the away first leg of the semi-final against Barcelona. It's like, well, yeah, they just want to be a bit more defensively solid. I don't see him making as many, all these defensive slips just because, that's what's amazing about him. He seems to attack like he does. And while maybe defending, he would say himself, isn't the most natural part of his game, it's the one that he's had to work the most at. Mm. I think he's kind of proved that adage that you can actually teach someone how to defend, because I think he's pretty good at it.
Defending is mainly about standing in the way.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Having a body there.
And don't try not to throw yourself out of the way. That's like, there's a real temptation at all times to do that. And if you can avoid doing that, then you're kind of 70% of the way there. He's good at getting back. Like he's quick, so he's good at getting back into position.
I'd say maybe another manager might think, okay, actually I'm going to put him at the fulcrum of my team. He's going to be the centre mid, but the way it's going with Klopp, I don't see it changing, and I don't see him being unhappy with it.
No, I mean, I think you know, you would be happy with what you're doing, but I do wonder if, you know, he is still very young. Klopp is there for a couple more years, I guess. I do wonder if he'll always be content to do what he's doing. But look, that wasn't really the point here.
Yeah.
I did sort of feel after this, like, the Harry Kane thing is going to come up this season for Tottenham, isn't it? They're going to have to sell him.
Well, Roy Keane says it.
Well, they should be. The Roy Keane thing is the best news Tottenham have had this season.
Why?
Well, if that kind of thinking still tells you. I mean, Keane doesn't work for Manchester United at the moment. He's got nothing to do with them. He speaks to a few of the people there, I guess. Maybe. Probably not, actually. It's Keane. But maybe there are people there who think like him. I mean, the manager, for instance, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, his former teammate and apparently friend. If they think, like Keane, that signing Harry Kane could solve a lot of problems for them, then Tottenham should be absolutely 100% taking that money and running, I think. I mean, again, if you look at Kane, there's like a kind of a decline, which is quite obvious now. It reminds you a little bit of Ozil. You know, we were just discussing Ozil's numbers kind of falling off. You know, Harry Kane, 2017-18, that's his top scoring season in the Premier League. 30 goals in 37 matches. Although his best season kind of goal in terms of scoring goals really is 29 and 30 in the season before. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you take it. You take it in either case. Since then, 17 goals last season, 6 so far this season in 10. But it's the shots that have gone way down. So his top scoring season it's more than 5 shots a game, and now it's like 2.5. Like, that's a big drop off.
But is that partly what we were talking about last week on the World Service, that he is getting frustrated, he's dropping deeper? This is a point that I think Peter Crouch was making on BT's Premier League coverage, Champions League coverage last week, that he's getting frustrated with the lack of service, so he's dropping deeper, and he is passing the ball around nicely. It's not like he's got a load of assists to his name in the Premier League, but yeah, he seems to have adopted this slightly deeper role.
Yes, but the thing is that the deeper role, if he's doing this, if he's kind of, let's say, becoming more of a Bergkamp than a Batistuta, to use the terms that we were talking about last week, then you might expect to see him creating more chances for teammates, and that's not happening either. So he's down to like half as many as he was making in his good time. So again, you just see a decline sort of across the board. And, you know, the question is whether Tottenham can find someone who's still impressed enough by what Harry Kane is or what Harry Kane used to be to gamble on the next 5 years of what he could be.
The other question is whether they... Yeah, I take your point. You can sell it, you can make loads of money, you might look very clever, only if you reinvest it wisely, which they didn't do with the Gareth Bale money, and they haven't exactly ripped up trees this summer when they finally loosened the purse strings for Pochettino.
That it's interesting, isn't it? The because there are a few examples of this, right? I mean, I think even worse than the Gareth Bale thing with Tottenham was the example of what Liverpool did when they sold Suarez, mm-hmm. and they bought like Lovren, Markovic, Lallana, who worked out to, you know, so Lovren and Lallana actually worked out to be okay signings.
They've contributed.
You know, and also, you know, if you look at the Tottenham one, who were the players they signed? Eriksen and Lamella. They're the ones who stuck. Lamella had injury problems, but he has been useful. Eriksen's obviously been one of their best, been probably their best player apart from Kane over this period. And then, okay, Soldado, Chadli, Paulinho. And Paulinho ended up going to Barcelona. Capoue and Vlad Chirichesi. Okay. That wasn't great. But surely Tottenham have to... You see, the thing is that if you have confidence in the essential structure of what you're doing as a club, then you must believe that you can spend the money wisely, you know? And I hear they have some young players coming through, Tottenham.
Well, they do. They've got a young Irish starlet.
I hear they have some young attacking players, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all seen what's been happening at Chelsea, you know? And who could fail to be blown away by Chelsea? And more masterful man management by Frank Lampard.
Go on.
Well, just, you know, like Chief Wiggum talking about it. We've been starving him, beating him, singing off key. Christian Pulisic, yeah. Unleashed at Burnley, absolutely runs riot, pulverizes Burnley's defense. And
perfect hat trick and all that.
Perfect hat trick. I mean, perfect hat trick wouldn't include a deflection, in my opinion, but.
Yeah, but
okay, but look, that's, you know, that's what is possible, and the reason why, you know, why would you sell Kane? It's stupid. It's so reactionary. Why would you say that? He's still one of the best players. Yeah, but he's a particular type of player. Is he really moving around enough anymore? Is he? He's not. You still see the shadow of what he was a couple of years ago. Is he really still like that? And how else are you going to rebuild this team? The team is dissolving. Alderweireld's leaving. Vertonghen's leaving, Eriksen's leaving, Danny Rose is probably leaving. You're not going to be in the Champions League. Well, it's unlikely now. So where's the money coming from to replace these players? I'm sure the U team is good, but like, it won't be seriously good. So you're going to have to get the money from somewhere. And this is
surely from all that money that the punters are paying over to attend the massive new stadium.
Yeah,
so part of that's more of a longer term.
No, that's good, game. But the stadium in itself is the finance of the stadium has been one of the restricting factors. Yeah. I mean, there's you know, there's
but that, my point is that those should pay should start becoming a benefit, but maybe that's not for a good few years.
It will be a benefit, but you know, it's not a benefit of the order of replacing 100 million euros which they made from the Champions League last season.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, it's you're going to make money from it, but like if everyone could make, if you know, a stadium can't add that much. Just the other thing was that over the weekend, the Liverpool New Balance judgment. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Liverpool have managed to successfully give New Balance the boot and get Nike on board as their new kit supplier, which I think everybody, you know, people are like, oh, do Nike make good stuff? They just make the same shirt for everybody. But obviously, it's a financial decision from their point of view. The court ruling was sort of interesting, though, because New Balance had an option to continue as the kit supplier if they matched the terms of any other potential kit supplier. If someone else made an offer, if New Balance matched it, then they could continue. So they said, well, we have matched it. And Liverpool said, no, you haven't. And so they ended up going to court. And the thing that makes a difference is, first of all, Liverpool were saying, Nike have said they're going to sell our gear in like 6,000 Nike-controlled stores and like thousands more worldwide, and New Balance can't do this. And New Balance said, no, we can. You know, here are all the doors is the term they use for shops that sell the gear. We've looked through all our regions, you know, and here's all these shops, these doors that could sell the gear. So yeah, we can do it. And like the court was sort of looking at New Balance emails going, hey, can we do this? You know, all this. But they figured ultimately that New Balance, although the figures were in some cases perhaps ambitious, were ultimately presented in good faith, which was the crucial point. So yeah, that was okay. In terms of the distribution, yeah, the court agreed New Balance's offer was okay. The whole case seems to have come down to the fact that Nike said in their Nike's thing was that we're going to have cross promotion with influencers of the caliber of LeBron James, Serena Williams, and Drake.
Yep, they can influence.
Not, you know, non-football athletes and influencers of the caliber. Drake obviously is not an athlete.
Near enough, he would. I'm pretty sure he was playing point guard for the Toronto Raptors last year when they won the NBA. He was interviewed more than any player anyway, at those games.
And New Balance, when they sort of sent in their document saying matching it, just didn't include this line. And they didn't include another line. Okay. They didn't include a line saying, you know, we're going to have, like, you've got Drake, but we've got, like, Dua Lipa or whatever. Yeah. There was no attempt made. So this is what it ultimately came down to. The court said, well, you can't, like, you haven't matched because you can't, you know, this is it. So, yeah, I guess we're going to see a lot of...
Contentious VAR call, that.
We're going to see a lot of this sort of stuff from Nike Liverpool next season when they've got Drake and so on and all these kinds of people plugging their merch.
John Delaney could run anything. I think the FAI are fortunate that they were able to track somebody of his caliber.
I'm delighted to announce on behalf of the FAI that Mick McCarthy is our new international manager.
It's 2 years' time. You know, we don't know what will happen.
The senior team is not my brief. My brief is the under-21 international team.
Further announcement today is that Stephen Kenny will commence as our under-21 manager.
What if he comes in and rips it up with the 21s?
In August 2020, I'm taking over, and that's been decided.
I want to give the amount of money. But I can say it's at least €100,000 in cash.
No, it's not in writing, it's just...
No, it's in writing, yeah.
We have to write the cheques tomorrow morning. The credit line and the ability to pay is there. Full stop.
We're in good shape, Dad. You just keep getting better. I got this.
We're announcing two grassroots initiatives today, Kent, for the Vantage seats. For as little as €100 a month on direct debit over 10 years, you can be assured of your Vantage seat.
You are... fucking idiot.
We have to do what we're doing. We have to do it. And we're doing it.
And after the Euros in 2020, Stephen will take charge of the senior international team.
Disgraceful reaction to that. But listen, I won't have to listen to it again, because that's the last game. I'll see you when I see you. I'm out of here.
Mick.
John Delaney for Roy.
Ah, how about that? A brand new Mark Horgan audio bed for your bank holiday pleasure. It helps if you've been watching Succession, but not essential.
Ken.
Oh, God. What's a Mick clip at the end there?
That's him leaving Ipswich.
Oh,
that was him. That was him.
He just gone.
I can't remember exactly what it was. But like the crowd had. There was some Shaka type situation. was it a substitute who got attacked by the crowd? Something like that.
Yeah, and he was like, you know, I'm out of here.
Yeah, but he's like, I'm not. You know, at least I don't have to put up with any of this shit anymore from you people. So see you later.
That sounded satisfying, anyway. Right, Billy and Jez from the F2 are here to talk about how to build the ultimate footballer. Hi guys.
Hi guys.
Hi guys. How you doing?
We're doing okay, yeah. You're in town to promote the Ultimate Footballer book, and there's an app that goes with it as well. I downloaded the app and looked at the book to try to see if I could perfect the Ozil bounce pass. I'm telling you, I'm not even gonna take it out onto the streets or into a park because it just looks a bit dangerous. How do you not injure yourself doing that?
To be fair, you can injure yourself doing that one. Because
you kind of kick right down into it.
Why I let Jez do that one.
Tell us, how did you guys get into this whole? Is it freestyle football? Is that what you would say? Or
I'm
throwing a term at you there.
No, we started off as freestyle footballers, which basically do the tricks as performers. We used to do stage shows. The biggest show we ever did was opening the Ballon d'Or ceremony with Messi, Ronaldo, Guardiola, anyone in football. Sir Alex Ferguson was there and we were on the stage doing football tricks where it's very easy to mess up and the ball can roll off the stage, which I actually did on Britain's Got Talent one time on live TV. But that's another story.
Right.
But anyway, that's what we used to do. Then we came together and started creating entertaining football content, and that's when things really started to take off, and it's just gone crazy since we made that move.
Who spotted the potential of that type of show? I mean, how did you when did you realize, hang on, we could have something really big here?
We evolved with it. So we started off as individual freestylers and performers, and then when we thought that's been seen and done, and it's hard to kind of
Make a business out of it? Is that it? Or scale it up? So many
people were doing the same thing. By the end of us doing our individual careers, so many people were doing freestyle. A lot of the new freestylers that come on the scene were working for free to try and get the publicity. So then all of a sudden your income starts dropping down. And we thought that a double act routine hasn't been done before, in sync, choreographed to music. And we went into that and we won the UK Entertainment Act of the Year award in 2013, I think it was. And then we were thinking, like, how can we progress this? And YouTube was new. You can get seen all over the world instantly. And you haven't got the pressure of having to perform live on stage to get that impact. So we saw it as an opportunity, and it wasn't a financial one. It was more about getting marketing our stage show, wasn't it? It's like, how many people, how can we build our fan base? And then we started realising you can, once we, about 2 years into it, you can monetize your videos and earn a living from doing that. So I guess we got in it at the right time. It took us about 2 years solid of grafting, uploading twice a week with no kind of like big movements in terms of views or audience, likes, comments.
Just consistent quality content that we believed in. And that's one of the pieces of advice that we give to youngsters nowadays. Like, it's a new generation, isn't it? They're all on YouTube, on Instagram, on all the different apps and stuff. And a lot of the kids now, if you ask them, what do you want to be when you're older? They say, I want to be a social media influencer, or I want to be a YouTuber. And one of the tips that we give to them is be yourself, be true to yourself, and create content that you believe in, even if other people aren't, you're not getting loads of views or people can write negative comments and stuff. Be true to yourself. And we had to do that for at least 2 years, and then it blew up.
How did it blow up? Did something specific happen?
There was a few virals that just went crazy, went everywhere, and then that really accelerates your growth. But again, like, some of the videos that you think are going to do millions of views, they absolutely tank, and then it's the surprising ones that you don't see coming. They can go.
What is there one in mind, a surprise hit that you thought, this is fine, but it's no better than what we've done, and suddenly everyone buys into it? Is there one that sticks out?
I mean, there's a few that have gone crazy. One of our biggest, of our most viewed videos ever is Messi versus Ronaldo, where one of us puts a Barcelona kit on, the other one puts a Real Madrid kit on. and we go head to head. In doing like trick shots and scoring goals and things, it's all scripted, but it's based around real stats. And that obviously has a massive global market, because football has a massive market, and you're picking the two best footballers on the planet. You're basically pretending to be them and giving real information about their stats, and it went really, really well.
When did you find players starting to want to get involved with what you were doing? I mean, because now, like, I mean, I've seen a good few of your videos. I mean, you're hanging out with Kevin De Bruyne and, you know, top players in the game. But I guess that wasn't the case at the beginning. When did they sort of start to say, or how did that work? I mean, do agents come to you? Do you talk to agents? Do players talk to you directly? What's the story?
Yeah, there's a few ways it kind of happens. So firstly, we've got a deal with Adidas, and we're global ambassadors, and they offer us player appearances because they know we can generate great content that gets views. So instead of Adidas doing an Adidas advert with a player that might not really do organic content that's good for YouTube, they allow us the time and we create content with the players that is normally fun, and we all have fun with it, and then make a great video. The other way is the players approach us because they want their social media, they want to get noticed. Or I'll give you an example. Christian Eriksen, we were filming with a few weeks back, and he was saying, like, I want to do a proper free kick video with you, but you're Adidas and I'm Nike. And he's like saying, like, how can we organise it? Like, because he wants to show the world how he can take free kicks exceptionally with his left foot and right foot, which people haven't seen before.
No.
So it would be a great video. So that's another way. And then the third way is brands. So brands that sponsor clubs or have players signed to them. Let's say it could be Monster energy drink, for instance, and they've got access to a football player, and they will say, okay, can you do this activation, and we're going to put it on your channel as a joint collaboration. So then we'll come with a brief, an idea for the shoot, and then execute it. So yeah, there's a few different ways, but ultimately it's great, because obviously getting a chance to film with footballers and see their ability, and so many of them, is brilliant for us, because we don't play in a pro game.
Yeah.
So it's good to mix it up with the guys.
So what is the difference then between somebody who's brilliant at tricks and somebody who's brilliant at, I suppose, what we could call field football?
Massive difference, really. In general, most of the top, well, all of the top freestylers in the world wouldn't be able to perform very well on field football, 11-a-side, or yeah, in a football match.
Yeah.
And likewise, most of the best footballers in the world, they wouldn't be able to compete in a professional freestyle tournament. And we kind of figured out very quickly, where's your mass market? Freestyle is very niche, whereas football is the biggest sport in the world.
Yeah.
So we started to gear our content much more towards real football. So it's not very freestyle-y. There might be the odd little trick or skill, but in general, like, some of our best videos have been like scoring amazing goals, for example, because everyone loves football, not everyone loves freestyle.
Yeah, I say that with freestyle compared to football, people think like, oh, you're good at freestyle, how are you not playing in the Premier League, for instance? It's kind of like chess and drafts. You've got the same, it's played on the same board, but two totally different games, skill sets, everything. Yeah. And that's how we put it, but we've got freestyle, but we come from a football background. We played for academies when we were younger. We played semi-pro. Then we chose to go into freestyle because it's better financially for us. And now, which is why we call the frame techers and tech, because it's not just freestyle, it's not just skills, it's technique. So anything to do with football on a pitch, whether it's passing, shooting, skills, we call it techers.
But is that whole environment and what you guys do, and the freestyle football, is all that actually feeding in now to, I don't know, is life imitating art in some ways, you know? Yeah. Jadon Sancho and these kind of guys have come up seeing this sort of stuff, as opposed to, like, when I was a kid, there were lots of kind of instruction manuals and stuff, but it would have been someone like Brian Robson, you know, here's how to make a driving run from midfield. I'm not disrespecting Brian Robson, but, you know, lion-hearted English player.
Ian St. John was doing the equivalent of this. Yeah,
Now you look at these young lads, and so many of them play in a way that was totally alien to English football 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, and the reason for that, I feel, is in this kind of what we've seen with freestyle when we first come onto the scene and put our videos on YouTube. Kids are seeing what the possibilities are and learning it at half the age of what you've learned it. Because it's accessible, you know. We launched an app a few weeks ago. I'm not trying to plug it, but The top score, I thought I had the top score until the developers told me someone scored 7,000. My top score was 2,000, and I thought, no one in the world has beat this. But once he said 7,000, it made me possible to go and get five, because I realised that it's reachable. And I feel like Jadon Sancho, these young, skillful players, are picking up so many different skill sets from the internet, from young, because it's all accessible to them, that they're learning it at such a young age.
It's a really good question you've just asked there, because we've filmed with quite a few of, in particular, the younger and up-and-coming players, the likes of Dele Alli, for example. And the first thing he said to us when we went to do a shoot with him for Adidas was, I've been watching your videos for years, guys. Love your stuff. And we're thinking, you're a Premier League player. And that's how it is now. The players that are current pros, where we've been doing it for a few years now, they grew up watching us.
Yeah, it's like completely, all the kind of cliches that I have in my head about English football is completely out of date. Like, it's happened so quickly before even realising. I mean, I remember reading like Zlatan Ibrahimovic's book a few years ago. He talks about how he would like collect, and this is like, you know, late 90s or whatever, he would obsessively try to find whatever little clips of Ronaldo he could get, and then just like watch and copy. But like his library was tiny. Like he had, you know, he had like 40 clips or whatever. But this is what he attributes essentially his, by the standards of that generation, extreme skill to, or like, you know, practicing this over and over. It's like every single kid is almost doing this now.
Yeah,
it's insane the level of technique that they now have.
Makes you ask the question, how far can it go with in terms of like freestyle skills and what the people are doing now? It's just, it's incredible. But what's it going to be like in 10 years time?
Yeah, I remember myself, top of my Christmas list one year was, I just wanted a Pele skills video from anywhere, Tesco, Sainsbury's. My mum couldn't find one. And Pele didn't even really do many skills. Whereas now, there's just an abundance of resource on YouTube and on the internet of whatever skills or techniques you want to see and learn. There'll be a tutorial and loads of videos and archive footage out there, which you can just freely access.
When you when you go to film something with a player, is there a kind of range in terms of how confident they are about their ability to sort of match up to what you're bringing? Like it,
there is.
There is. Yeah. Right. It's funny because some of them get intimidated. It's really strange. I think they see that other footballers have been on videos and there's an expectation to do well.
The big thing is they know we're always on their side. So
you're not trying to make fools of them, like,
no,
even a little bit, like
even a little bit.
We never compete with them. It's not like it's never F2 versus, and we want to beat them. It's like kind of a joint collaboration. Even if we position it as a battle, when you actually watch the video, it's never a battle.
And we've seen a lot of other skills experts. They see an opportunity of player access. They see that as an opportunity to try and exploit them, to try and make themselves look good and the player look bad. The way we've built our business is everyone we film with, we do our best to make them look as good as possible. And the way to not do that is trying to mug them off or embarrass them. So we're always on side with them, and they pick that up very quickly that it's a team effort.
There must be some of them, though, and you can name these people who just get on set, they get there, they meet you, they go, right, I'm going to own this.
Like,
yeah, I'm going to dominate. Is there anyone that struck you as, I can see why this guy's made it.
There's a couple. Well, we won't name them, obviously.
You don't want to name them? No, but this is a positive.
This is a positive, and like, yeah. I'll give one example, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Okay, right? that's not surprising.
And you can see it, and that's why he's like known as the best player in the world. Okay, Messi, it's debatable, but let's say Cristiano Ronaldo, he has got that. Whatever it is, he wants to be the best at it, 100%. And that mentality is I've got admiration for it, because he's so dedicated and always wants to be the best.
But he is actually unbelievable. He's not one of the shocking ones.
Yeah, no, he's like...
Good. He thinks he's good and he is good.
Yeah.
There's a few that have thought they're good and then it doesn't go right for them. But then you have good days and bad days as well. And a lot of these players, it's funny because we're very used to shooting on shoots where there's cameras everywhere and you're trying to get hard techniques with the football. A lot of players, they're used to playing in matches, but take them outside of that and stick cameras everywhere and say, hit that target, they can get nervous. Yeah. So again, it falls under our roles and responsibilities to try and make the players feel as comfortable as possible.
Because Michael Owen was in here last month, I think, and one of the things he had talked about in his book was how terrified he was of having to do the unveiling at Real Madrid, where he would have to come out and like he couldn't do it. He was like, I can't. So he actually ended up just grabbing each ball and just lashing into the crowd as a way of getting around, hoping nobody noticed that he didn't do tricks. But do you never have performance anxiety? I mean, you mentioned the FIFA awards or whatever. Have you ever kind of turned on and gone, this is not really my day today?
Well, it sounds like the Strictly one was one of those times, wasn't it?
Oh, BGT.
Oh, sorry.
No, I went in overconfident and I dropped the ball in every rehearsal but thought it would be all right on the night. And it wasn't. So I learned an important life lesson there.
Describe the sinking feeling there for us, Jess. I'm not looking for tears here, but that must have been tough.
Oh, it was really tough. It was like I was crying and everything, and Simon Cowell walked past me and Piers Morgan. They were like watching me cry, and it was like...
enjoying it.
Piers maybe a bit. But you know, it's the lows that make the highs more satisfying, and where we've come, how we've bounced back. It's like we've all had setbacks and stuff, and now we don't even really do freestyle tricks anymore, do we? It's just content, and we've built amazing businesses around the following that we've built up. Our social reach is now just past 20 million people. And we've managed to get that many people engaged in what we do through content, right?
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, you've talked about entertainment a bit, but it's also instruction, you know, and I know Simon's son, Sevi, for example, is obsessed with your videos, and he just loves getting detail on skills to work on and this kind of stuff, which feeds into, you know, there's this idea that kids are kind of lazy, you know, they might play a bit of structured sport, but they don't really do stuff in their own time. And certainly we hear this sometimes when it comes to Irish football, that the kids aren't out there playing street football like they used to back in the day, and they're not getting the hours with the ball and all that kind of stuff, as though there's some sort of a lack of a work ethic. But judging by the success you guys have had and the likes of Simon's son and many others who are watching you and practicing, kids do want to get better, you know. Maybe part of it is a show off kind of a thing, but there's obviously a willingness to learn how to get better at football.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the difficulty is they have so many other options of it for entertainment. Mm. When we were younger, going out on the street, playing in the street football, climbing a tree was probably the limit of it. That's what we'd done every single day. So that was our options. It's what we love doing. They love playing football, but also they've got these computer games that are really entertaining and so like sophisticated now, addictive. So it's kind of like pulling them away. And what we try and do in our YouTube channel, and even YouTube, you know, kids want to sit on there rather than actually going out and doing it themselves. So that's why we try and make a lot of our content active and set challenges for kids to go and try and get out there with a football, because we know the importance of it. I've got kids myself, and this the last thing I want to see them do is stuck on a tablet or a computer all night. I want them to experience going out and playing like they should do and being active.
I wonder what the next generation's going to say. Will they be like, oh, when we were young, we used to be on our iPads, on our phones. This new generation, look at them. They're just, I don't know.
Whatever they're doing. No, it's totally true.
It's
totally
difficult,
true.
Isn't it? Because we are, like, we understand it. We're not from that generation. So we're trying to, like, put caps on it and make sure kids do this. But the next generation, our kids were born into this technology. So what are they going to be like with their children? Are they going to be like, just stay on the iPad? Well, mum never let me. But
One thing I do wonder from a football point of view is whether one thing you can already see is that I don't know if there's a chance of FIFA and Pro Evo kind of almost becoming bigger spectator sports than football. Football. I mean, I remember being at the Champions League final in Milan, and they were playing like a FIFA final on the big screen, you know, before the game, and it was it was quite funny to see the whole San Siro sitting there watching this like game. But like you can see that this is. If you're a kid, there's no difference really between this and like what's on Sky. There's no difference. It's just as good to watch. So do you think that is going to be a thing to change? I mean, you mentioned earlier, say, freestyle being a niche sort of thing, but I wonder, is it growing faster? Like, are these kinds of developments that we're going to see, the actual kind of old school game becoming, well, less dominant over these other forms of the game?
It's a really good question. And if you look at what you can earn from being a gamer now and playing FIFA, Call of Duty. I mean, I think the winner of the Call of Duty championships earns £24 million. So
it's like more than almost every footballer.
Yeah, and you can earn that from being a 16-year-old as well. They're like these kids that are winning these tournaments are young.
£24 million.
I think you've got to be a part of a team of four or five.
You're thinking about going
into the business.
Ken, we need you. At least
give
us
that PS4.
At least hand in some notice before.
Yeah. But it goes to show you that you can make a career out of gaming, which is why kids now they play it as a hobby, but also it can be their job as well. I feel like kids do love, or people do love, watching other gamers play. They really do. I guess it's because when they play, they can see it and have a comparison to their own skills and what they're doing, and appreciate how hard it is to do what they're doing. Will it ever overtake football? I don't know, but esports is growing so fast. I'd like to think it won't, but esports is growing so fast. I think it's the fastest growing sport in the world, right? Yeah.
Well, is real football even real football, or is it just a simulation?
Don't open that can of worms.
I'm playing.
All right, guys. Well, listen, it's been fascinating having you in. The book is Ultimate Footballer, and you've plugged the app as well, Billy. But it's fine. You know, there's no problem.
Sorry,
there's no problem at all.
We've got two for the price of one.
Exactly.
We sneaked that one in.
Yeah,
then.
You've flown in. You've come over. You've had the chat. We appreciate it. You've been great company. Thanks a million.
Thanks a lot, guys. Keep up the good work.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Lion. 51551 is our text number, and Joe at rt.ie from wherever you are in the world. Ken, good afternoon.
How are you?
You saw it. What happened?
I mean, I actually was abused by a Dane as well.
Mm-hmm.
The night before.
Go ahead.
I was having dinner after the you know, we finished our work or whatever on Friday, went into town, we were sitting in a restaurant.
You were a journalist and...
myself and three other journalists. Mm-hmm. And at some point it turned out we were all looking at our phones simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were waiting in a bill or something. Mm-hmm. And this Danish guy staggered up from behind, sort of suddenly leaned over the table and he goes,
"Go ahead.
Is there a Wi-Fi in here?"
The whole thing, Ken, the whole thing is getting more and more bizarre. You didn't do it, did you report that to the FAI or anything?
We were like... actually, we're just on the 3G. Mm-hmm. Before we could finish explaining we weren't actually on the Wi-Fi, he goes, "Wi-Fi wankers! You're all Wi-Fi wankers!"
Did he write this himself? Did he compose this line himself?
You know, all he'd seen was four... I don't know how he knew we were Irish, but he knew. "Wi-Fi wankers! You're all Wi-Fi wankers!"
As a matter of interest, what made you think of Ian St. John when I mentioned the old manuals we had as kids?
Because I had one.
Is it this one by any chance?
Hang on.
Have a look at that.
That looks... looks like a professional advice for me. Yeah, this looks like it.
Improve your soccer skills.
This is the one.
Usborne super skills. Interesting they keep using the word soccer. It looks like they've targeted the American audience in the mid to late 1980s there.
Soccer. Well, it may simply have been that the posh people at the publishing company assumed that football was something was related to rugby somehow. I don't know, soccer.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. No. This is the same one.
Well, I knew there's the saint. Yeah, the saint. A letter from Ian St. John.
This is a bit more text heavy than the F2 one. On the other hand, does it have app functionality?
I don't think video app functionality.
No.
The Usborne super skills improve your soccer skills.
I can actually remember, lofted past like. Lofted pass. I can remember all this. Oh my god!
Throw it over again for a sec. There's something I just leafing through it there. So they have a quiz at the end. Where is it? Soccer quiz at the end, right? Your score: 0 to 15 is poor. 16 to 30 is average. 31 to 45 is good. And over 45 is genius.
Genius.
It appears I filled this out at some point in the late '80s.
Yeah.
What do you think my score was?
47.
39, Ken.
39.
Well into the good range. Although having a closer look, I think I might have been a little generous to myself when I totted these up.
Well, what kind of questions?
In which cities are the following well-known clubs based? So Juventus, I write Italy, and then give it a tick. Everton, I write England, little tick there.
Well, look, that's...
I'm struggling with the nationality. Right. Graham Souness, I say he's English. I mean, that's not a bad guess.
Well, I mean, he's Brexit. So
Johan Cruyff, I said, was Spanish. Again, like, not the worst guess.
No, exactly. I mean, there's definitely a Spanish element to his personality.
If I got this in the year it was published, 1987, I was only 7 years of age. So yeah. I forgive myself some of these answers. If I was a bit older, which I think I might have been, I should be getting more of those, right?
They've got all the stuff about the studs in there as well, the screw-ins and molded studs.
Oh, it literally tells you that how to, I don't know where it is, be a manager yourself. It tells you how to, oh, here it is. Becoming a professional, right? They have a path to the first team. So you play at school, you play at the club, you become an apprentice, a reserve, first team, all that kind of stuff.
And there's years of hazing, bullying, abuse.
Well, it does tell you how to do contracts, how to work out a first team contract. It goes to training, transfers, and retirement. Soccer players...
cradle to grave.
Soccer players retire young. About 30 to 34 is normal, although some players, particularly goalkeepers, can go on until they are 40. Many players are forced out even earlier by injury. Many ex-players go into soccer management or become trainers. Others invest their earnings in business enterprises or become sports writers.
Become sports writers.
Nothing about owning a pub here, which is the biggest one of the lot of that.
Business enterprises. Yeah, this is a book for children.
They don't need to know all that. Okay, yeah. I'm going to actually have a nice read of this and see. Maybe I will practice, Ken. Maybe I will get better at football.
That book is in great condition.
Unbelievable condition.
More than 30
years. Found it this morning and was so delighted. I don't have anything in this mint condition, to be honest.
Fair play.
Throw it on eBay?
No.
Get a tenner?
Keep it on. It's got a tenner, 15 value. Euro for it. That's your childhood.
I'm going to keep it. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Enjoy the rest of your Bank Holiday weekend. We will talk to you with the Rugby Podcast on the World Service tomorrow. If you're not already signed up, you can do it on secondcaptains.com/join.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.